Welcome back. It's a Wednesday, the 8th day of May, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's work our way up the crime and outrage chain today, starting with the less obscene that would have been considered off the top just a few years back to the increasingly more obscene, starting with, say, this one. And I can't say that it's in the least surprising. Migrants are now renting children in order to be able to get into and then stay in the U.S., knowing that what now passes for immigration law in the United States allows so-called families, and I guess that includes a couple of perverts with some child sex slaves, to stay. They've been renting them for that purpose now for years. Illegal alien invaders, says the piece by R. Court Kirkwood in The New American, have adopted a new tactic in their war against American sovereignty. They rent illegal alien children to cross the border with them because they know U.S. immigration authorities are releasing almost all of the migrant families that they apprehend. It's such a problem, said the Arizona Daily Star, that on Saturday, Immigration and Customs Enforcement started a new program to catch the fraudsters, moving teams of special agents to the border to detect the increasing number of fakers. And the Star reported that the Yuma sector of the Border Patrol has already counted 700 fake families. Those are the ones that they've caught since just October, since ICE's Homeland Security Investigations Bureau dispatched more agents to the area to investigate. And basically, it goes on to say they're going to use biometrics and describe some of the many techniques that the new brand of criminals, and of course, terrorists among them, have decided to adopt in order to continue doing what they've been doing so successfully. Item number two, and it's not the story itself, it's the story about the story that I think is the outrage. The Attorney General of Oklahoma has again requested, this time he was heard, that President Trump pardon a former Army First Lieutenant who was convicted of murdering an Iraqi prisoner while deployed there in self-defense in 2008. Here then, the first couple of paragraphs of the USA Today story, under an interesting headline, ACLU blasts Trump pardon of soldier Michael Behanna as, quote, endorsement of a murder. Note that they don't use those same headlines when it comes to Arkansas. Dateline, Washington, the American Civil Liberties SICK Union on Tuesday blasted President Donald Trump's decision to pardon that Army First Lieutenant convicted of killing an Iraqi prisoner. They don't say it, but I will. Allegedly in self-defense, claiming the move amounted to a, quote, presidential endorsement of a murder. Trump granted the pardon late Monday to Michael Behanna, Oklahoma man who was sentenced to 15 years in 2009 for killing a terrorist named Ali Mansour Mohammed, suspected Al-Qaeda operative who was stripped naked for questioning before being shot. Here's the rest of the story, folks. This doesn't appear in the Waystream editions. It doesn't mention that they had intel saying this guy was a terrorist, then were ordered to release him, much less that this Al-Qaeda operative had, quote, blown up and killed two of Behanna's fellow soldiers with an IED, unquote. And if what they don't bother to tell you isn't bad enough, what they add seems to be even... What they add is no less hypocritical. Trump concludes the piece has frequently used his clemency power to make political statements, pardoning conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza, who was hammered, folks, as a political prisoner, former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, ditto, and former Bush White House aide Scooter Libby, among others. Well, they admit, quote, that's hardly unprecedented, but previous presidents have tended to grant their most controversial pardons in their final months in office. Insert. Oh, do you mean like President William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, who famously on his midnight raid pardon set, last day in office, granted pardons to the likes of Mark Rich, international commodities trader and convicted mass felon, 65 counts no less, from wire fraud to racketeering? Even the New York Times, for crying out loud, called it, quote, a shocking abuse of presidential power. Fellow Democrat and former President Jimmy Carter said the pardon sure looked like it was attributable to, quote, his large gifts. In my opinion, that was disgraceful, unquote. And a retrospective headline from the Chicago Tribune even admitted the Clinton pardon of Rich was a, quote, saga of power and money, as well as secrecy, tenacity, sleight of hand, and pressure from Rich's ex-wife, including a million-dollar donation, along with one of her friends, who together have steered multiple millions of dollars to Bill and Hillary, and those of other Democrats. Whether it's also a story of bribery or illegal gifts from abroad is the subject of congressional inquiries, said the Chicago paper almost two decades ago. As well as a criminal investigation by the FBI, well, you know what happened to that one, and a U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. So here's the bottom line, folks. This piece of yellow journalistic crap is comparing a presidential pardon of a soldier in a war zone acting under, well, at least severe pressure and who knows what else, to a criminal pardoned by a criminal in response to a bribe. No wonder Clinton unleashed that torrent on his very last day in office. Well, they say Trump has done so early in his presidency, as if there was any comparison. But lies aside, there's one thing for sure, folks. This one wasn't tainted by the stench of bribery. So, moving on up the corruption chain. Here's one from Zero Hedge, aggregated from several sources. Former British spy, the infamous Christopher Steele, made a stunning admission during an October 11, 2016 meeting. Did you hear about that yet? Now we'll know why. With Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kathleen Kavalec, just 10 days before the FBI used his now discredited dossier to justify securing a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA court, so-called warrant, to spy on the Trump campaign and his aide Carter Page and the campaign's ties to Russia, according to The Hill's John Solomon. A type summary of the meeting, which sat buried, imagine that, for fully 2.5 years until an open records litigation by something called Citizens United Steele managed to get a hold of the documents, said that his client, Steele, is, quote, keen to see this information come to light prior to November 8th. Remember what day that was? Yeah, the election. Also in the meeting was an employee of Steele's Orbis security firm, Tatiana Duran. And according to The Hill, Kavalec's notes of the meeting, including this stunning admission, do not appear to have been provided to the House Intelligence Committee for its Russia probe, according to former Chairman Devin Nunes of California. Quote, they tried to hide a lot of documents from us during our investigation, and it usually turns out there's a reason for it, he told John Solomon, who notes that one member of Congress had transmitted the memos of the DOJ's Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, out of concern that the IG's office had never been allowed to see it either. So here's what happened. The FBI retroactively classified Kavalec's notes on 4/25/2019. Huh? That was just a few days ago. Despite the fact that it was originally marked unclassified, well, before it really mattered anyway, especially if Hitler had won as planned back in 2016. And they set it for a declassified date of 12/31/2041, 25 years after the 2016 election. Are you starting to see the pattern here? Evidently, the effort to hide Kavalec's notes from her contact with Steele has persisted for quite some time. The Hill puts it this way in context. Documents and testimony from Department of Justice official Bruce Orr, whose wife Nellie worked for Fusion GPS, show that he told the FBI in August 2016 that Steele was, quote, desperate to defeat Trump and that his work had something to do with Clinton's campaign. Kavalec's notes make it clear that the DNC was a likely client and the election was Steele's deadline to smear Trump. And furthermore, it says, there's little chance the FBI didn't know that Steele, then a bureau informant, had broken protocol and gone to the State Department in an effort to make the Trump dirt public. President of Citizens United David Bossie said this new information proves why the Attorney General must conduct a thorough investigation of the so-called investigators, adding that Kavalec's notes suggest there was an illegal effort to frame the now president with bogus collusion allegations. And according to at least one source who's seen the notes, they also contain information on Steele's political ties, which, oh, I hope you're sitting down, haven't been given to Congress. There's also a connection to Hitlery in the notes, said the source, and who is surprised by that? After all, we are talking State Department here, aren't we? Even with the redactions, the story notes, the significance of Kavalec's notes is monumental because they constitute definitive proof that the U.S. government had full knowledge that the foundation of the FISA warrant had a specifically political motive and an election day deadline that they were looking ahead to. We also know, according to the report, that this information was transmitted before the Page warrant to people whose job is so sensitive that their identities had to be protected. In short, there's virtually no way the criminally evil FBI didn't know exactly who they were dealing with and what they were doing. From there, we have to go to outright treason with a clear intent to foment civil war. So let's start with the nutcase communist first, then the creepy one. New Jersey Senator, and it's painful to say that, Cory Booker, has made headlines recently for his list of wildly unconstitutional and outright inflammatory gun control infringements. At the top of his list, of course, is requiring a Big Brother's license in order to buy, keep, much less bear, a firearm, in spite of that stinking Constitution thing that he hates so much. To make the case, Booker argues that if one needs a license to drive a car, well, in spite of the Constitution, we're going to say the same thing about a gun. The article from Ammoland asks the question I've asked for years this way. If he was talking about a poll tax instead, or an infringement on the not explicitly constitutionally protected right to vote, hey, let's just tax people or give them a test before they're allowed to exercise something that arguably could kill a lot more people than anybody's managed to do with a gun yet, like vote. You can hear the caterwauling already, can't you? How about a license to exercise speech? Well, to Facebook is well on their way to that. And when it comes to a license to worship, well, the IRS has been coming at that one through the back door for years. And Gulag and Twitter, for their part, can just shadow ban and manipulate your search results. Same effect, though. Understand, though, when they get around to explicitly requiring a license to worship, it'll probably only apply, at least at first, if you want to worship the God of the Bible. All right, well, how about the creepy communist who wants to be king? And he is basically less left than most of the people that he's running against. Not quite such a knee-jerk nutcase. And he knows how to sell the big lie with more subtlety. We're talking former VP Joe Biden, who in a Tuesday speech to Nevada socialists acknowledged, well, there may still be a Second Amendment, at least for the time being, but we need to deal with it rationally. And no, I'm not going to quote this whole obscene thing, but after citing the standard false flags and the lies about them, from Sandy Hook to Las Vegas, he said, quote, and I just want to say to you, there's a Second Amendment, but there's a rational way to deal with the Second Amendment. And then he added, yes, I just want to let you know that we can do it rationally.
But that's not what worried me. It's how to do it. These things must be done delicately, or you hurt the staff.
Although he never defined what doing it rationally means, the Wicked Witch certainly did. So I guess after all of that, it's time for a good news break, albeit briefly. Even some of the jihadist left is starting to wake up to just how far gone things seem to already be, especially as some of the old left, especially the libertarian old left, begins to distance themselves from the increasingly unrestrained nutcases. So two stories. The first one, courtesy of Breitbart, quotes Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, who has come out and warned that so-called representatives like Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan are normalizing, his word, Islamism in American politics and culture. He offered his remarks in a Tuesday interview on SiriusXM's Breitbart News Daily with host Alex Marlowe, where he was offered to comment on a Friday report of a video depicting Muslim children wearing Palestinian attire and singing jihadist songs. It was shared by the Muslim American Society Islamic Center in Philadelphia on their two Facebook page. Notice they may be advocating violence, but they're not banned. Said Jasser, quote, people see these clips and they think it's just an aberration or a one-off. Even the bizarre Philadelphia Inquirer, he continued, had the temerity to have a reporter report after this was going viral that the heads of the school said this was just an oversight and it wasn't properly vetted. The only thing he said that wasn't properly vetted was that some parent posted that. Jasser continued, the bottom line is that the Muslim American Society has 35 chapters, and among those chapters, they run a number of charter and private schools. It is, according to the Chicago Tribune, and he pointed out this is no vast right-wing conspiracy, the Chicago Tribune had a large three-part series all the way back in 2004 with an undercover Muslim reporter in one of their schools in Chicago, showing that they are clearly the mirror image, or they are, literally, the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, unquote. And he goes on to provide more and more detail, including a school in Minnesota, not too far from Ilhan Omar's district, that was shut down a few years back, because they were using tax money to force kids into prayer and doing fundamentalist Salafi jihadi-type ideology, which he also said was a bit under the national radar. That school's now been shut down, but a lot of their leaders have reopened institutions under other names in the area, which he said shows you that this is, quote, an endemic deep problem. And here's the bottom line, folks, and it is refreshing to see somebody come out from within, at least an Islamic community, and say exactly what the problem is. Democrats and the broader left, said Jasser, politically exploit Muslims with narratives of victimization, and these left-wing analytical frameworks prevent leftists from accurately addressing problems, cultural, political, social, religious, or otherwise, within Muslim communities and groups. Quote, we're missing the story because nobody wants to connect non-violent Islamism to violent Islamism, said Jasser. This video got people's attention because you had kids talking about chopping off heads. But all the other things in that video about the supremacy of Islamic rule, the antagonism against the Jews, and other things, that's ignored because it's perceived as non-violent, but it is the gateway drug into radical Islamism. And he went on to say these ideas and movements, I believe, are increasing. They're actually getting much more brazen, he said, as folks like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are normalizing their relationships with Hezbollah supporters, with Hamas supporters, and others. This seems to now have open access into various congressional offices. I think the amount of it hasn't changed much, but it's becoming much more prime time, if you will, because they feel unchecked. They're basically given sort of the reign of the left, and the most radical in Congress seem to be leading the left's platform. And then he summarized it this way. Our community has a deep radicalization problem. It has a theocracy problem. And he went on to reject left-wing identity politics as, quote, un-American, and contrary to the very ethos of E Pluribus Unum. Quote, as our founding fathers fought for freedom, religious freedom, liberty against theocracy, the American dream is a positive ethos. We can only defeat our enemies if we know what we're for. The left, all their presidential candidates from Antifa to Move On, they really don't know what they're for other than confiscating our money through taxes and socialism and also confiscating our other rights. At the end of the day, added Dr. Zudi Jasser, this is the reason I'm a conservative. Our movement understands what we're for. We know we're for less government interference, we're for national security, we're for equality and freedom for all, and we're for religious freedom. Wow. And on that good news scale, even some of the left in Hollywood can almost recognize extreme censorship Nazi style when they see it. From J.D. Hayes at Natural News, while you might think that A-list actors, either in Hollywood or New York, who make their living entertaining Americans, should be more sensitive to overt censorship, some claim to remember McCarthyism. The fact that so many of them are to the left of Karl Marx means too many have no problems if the right people are the ones getting censored. Oftentimes, they call for more and more people to be banned, censored from the public square, especially on socialist media, simply because they disagree with their political, cultural, or non-socialist views, or especially religious views and opinions. But actor Rob Schneider seems to be an exception to the far-left Hollywood types insofar as his concerns that he calls them progressive Democrats and their like-minded allies in big tech are actually going too far when it comes to pushing for more Orwellian censorship. Snyder, it says, launched a half dozen tweets over the weekend in which he criticized the various socialist tech giants for ramping up their censorship program against what they call far-right figures. And to that end, as many have reported by now, Facebook has deplatformed and even depersoned not only Alex Jones and his InfoWars news sites, but former editor-at-large Paul Joseph Watson, conservative activist Laura Loomer, and a whole bunch of others. By the way, they did put Louis Farrakhan on the list for plausible deniability, and those of us who actually believe in free speech would point out he has no business being censored either, of course. Schneider began by retweeting a post from investigative reporter Cheryl Atkinson warning about the never-ending campaigns by the socialist giants, to Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and others, to ban mostly conservative voices. She asked, when did we decide as Americans that it's okay for government and third parties to censor or curate our info? That we can't be trusted with the unfiltered info? That we should only be able to find out what they tell us is true are matters that are clearly opinion or in legitimate dispute? And she signed it hashtag slippery slope. Inspiring Rob Schneider to tweet, quote, we are in a real world Orwellian nightmare of censorship. Be careful who you label and smear today. You will be smeared tomorrow. And he followed that up with his own thoughts on the subject, noting that the sudden atmosphere of blatant censorship by left-wing so-called progressive Democrats and their supporters is getting downright, and his word is, bizarre. Just bizarre, he said. Progressive Democrats who once stood for civil rights, liberty, free speech, now stand for censorship and remove parent rights, he wrote. In another post, he added, free speech is all speech, and said, the UK and Australia don't have protected speech, and we're not protecting our First Amendment. Hashtag eternal vigilance. So yeah, folks, there are at least a few on the left that are starting to really awaken. No, the opposite of woke, to what they, or at least some of them, are up to. And Orwell did have it right. On then, as we wrap up again today, to the economic meltdown, still in progress. Like this story to start us off, there's more than one way to have a trade war. It's not just tariffs. You can also destroy a nation's currency. China boycotts, says another Zero Hedge headline, a shockingly ugly tailing 10-year auction. Indirex plunge, and it's the lowest bid-to-cover ratio in 10 years. Well, begins the piece, there's just one word to describe today's just-concluded sale of $27 billion in 10-year notes. Disastrous. Sparking immediate speculation that if China simply decided not to show up for today's budget deficit funding operations, the 10-year auction was ugly from top to bottom. Now, some of the numbers are a little bit inside baseball, but here we go. The high yield of 2.479% tailed, the when issued 2.465% by a whopping 1.4 basis points, the biggest tail since August of 2016. It was so big that whereas the auction was initially expected to price to the lowest yield since December of last year, the disappointing reception meant the yield actually rose compared to last month. But if the tail was bad, it continues the internals were far worse, starting with the bid-to-cover ratio, which plunged from 2.55 to 2.17. And it goes on to give some other numbers, but suffice it to say, just maybe, Communist China is sending a message, because overall, it was a very ugly auction. And if the message sending was the point, it looks like they succeeded, judging by what they call the violent repricing in the 10-year, whose immediate yield promptly blew out by over 2 basis points. And a couple of comments to wrap things up via Greg Hunter's USAWatchdog.com and money manager Michael Pento, who warns, don't confuse a near-record high stock market with actual strength and resiliency, because what we have, he says, is just the opposite. Quote, there are some people who will listen to this and say, hey, Mr. Pento, why are you such a Cassandra? Why are you so down? Don't you know the stock market is doing great? Don't you know I have a job? But here's the thing, he said, the entire edifice, the entire construct is artificial. It's controlled by governments and central banks. Hence, it is much more fragile, infinitely more fragile, than if it was dictated by the free market. And this, he said, echoing other Austrians, is, this has to end badly because the distortions have to be reconciled. It was once okay to have recessions and corrections in the stock market when the stock market was not the economy. But asset prices have become the economy. Therefore, they lead the economy and they don't follow the economy. Yes, he said, this is going to end badly, I am sorry to say. Well, what does that mean? Quote, you'll eventually get a recession, or eventually you'll get inflation, and probably you'll get both. You might just get a huge case of stagflation to hit this country and around the world. That, he said, is what I'm most afraid of. He goes on to note that Japan has no growth, neither does Germany nor Italy. We have an earnings recession here in the U.S. So what you've engendered is most likely a protracted period of stagflation, which will lead to an epic and massive crash in asset prices. That's what you have at your feet, he said, so be careful. And he's right, folks, because fake money systems always end badly, and the U.S. fiat dollar won't be the first exception in human history. We'll close, though, with just this headline. Call it one more bit of good news. As the establishment trots out James Comey to slam Attorney General William Barr on national TV, there's an op-ed in The Hill that summarizes what's really going on, hopefully, and that is, James Comey is in trouble, and he knows it. Unquote, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.